Did you study at Iowa or teach there, or both?
Both. I was in the graduate program for 2 years as a student in 65 and 66, and then I taught there from 72 to 75.
God, I think that Iowa probably has produced more people that I have talked to in the last 3 or 4 years. This week I talked to Jane Ann Phillips, and I think she was there approximately your time, wasn't she? Maybe not. But
no, Jane Ann would have been a student there, I think, after I stopped being a teacher.
Tom Boyle.
Tom Boyle was a student.
Tom, that's right. That's your name came up this week because I talked to Tom Caragas and Boyle.
Right.
Whose name I had never pronounced correctly until he straightened me out on that. Yeah, he was there then. Phillips was there, and God, there's so many people who have gone to Iowa. It must have a wonderful. It certainly has a reputation being the outstanding school for writers in this country.
Well, you see, I think it's the outstanding school simply because the outstanding young writers go there. I don't think anybody's taught anything there. I wasn't taught anything there, and I'm sure I never taught anyone a single thing about writing. I think what happens in a good writing program is that the young writers who are talented and who are capable find an audience. For the first time, they get a very serious audience. They get to hear that as well as they've done something, there will always be smart and less smart people who will completely misunderstand it, and there will also be people who will completely get it. And it's a great experience. It's a way of knowing how you sound to other people, and to, in a way, a more interested and concerned group of other people than you're likely to confront in any audience at random. When I was there as a student, I worked with Vance Bourgeli, I worked with Kurt Vonnegut, who really was a second father to me. But I can't remember that they told me to do anything that I wasn't already doing, so much as they made me feel that I wasn't deluded in continuing to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the best that I was ever able to contribute as a teacher. It's not a teaching student situation. It's a community, and I remember very clearly, for having been there in two different capacities, one as a student, one as a teacher, that the real listening that the young writers did was to their peers.
Are you currently teaching? Or do you teach on a sporadic basis now, or is that...
No, I don't do it anymore. I mean, it's...
Gone forever?
Well, it's... I grew up in an academic community. My father taught at Phillips Exeter, and I taught for 12 years. I taught and coached in various schools and colleges, and I liked it well enough. It wasn't crippling work, which I think it is to a number of other writers. I think a number of writers feel that teaching or talking about literature in some way exercises the same muscle they need to do their own writing. I never felt that way, but it did intrude in my time. And I always say to people, imagine trying to be a good doctor 2 hours a day. Imagine having a law practice 2 hours a day. That's the condition for most serious writers in this country, and certainly was the one I long accepted, and I long expected that I would have to always have a job or two in addition to my writing. I had the feeling that I was supporting a rather expensive habit, and to suddenly be able to be self-supportive at what I want to do 9 or 10 or 12 hours a day instead of just 2 hours a day. That's just a luxury I would never give up.
You know, writing for most writers is just not a full-time job. Or if it is a full-time job, it still has to be supplemented by other forms of income. When you taught your students, how did you handle them? I was talking to Stanley Elkin recently.
Stanley's a great teacher. Yeah. Well, we taught together at Iowa.
Well, I've had mixed reports about that. Now, not 2 weeks before I was talking to Elkin, William Gass was here. Now, Gass was also teaches at Washington University in St. Louis, so he's a colleague and friend of Stanley Elkin. And they're having this running battle about the best way of teaching students. Elkin has a reputation of bullying his students and shouting at his students. And I wondered if that's true, if that is an appropriate way of handling artists or would-be artists, because it seemed to me that they need care, pampering, praise, encouragement. And Elkin says, well, if I'm rough on the students, I'm giving them the truth. If I don't like what they've done, it doesn't reflect my sense of aesthetics, and I'm giving them my opinion. I'm telling them the truth, even if it hurts. And I don't know if that's... Well, anyway, what is your approach? What is the best way of handling an aspiring writer?
I agree with Stanley altogether, although I was never much of a shouter. I don't think I'm a bully with my students either. My manner of voicing my displeasure with what someone had written was to simply remain unenthusiastic about it, was to be clearly not nearly as excited about it as the author was. But I think that if you're going to be a writer in this or in any society, you better quickly be able to separate the aesthetic and humane convictions in your work that you will stand behind from those that other people can argue you out of. And it doesn't hurt to develop a thick skin rather quickly. I think the kind of response you get in the academic community to your work, however loud or bullying or even just plain aggressive it is a lot more personally directed and a lot more caring than the responses you're likely to encounter from total strangers. And you have to adopt very quickly a notion of just why you're doing this.
A thick skin. William Styron has complained that he's never had a good review in the New York Times, and John Gardner a few years ago wrote a front page review of Sophie's Choice on the New York Times Sunday Book Review, and it just took this novel of Cole's, and I was surprised when I read it because I thought it was a masterpiece. Recently, a collection of critical essays about Styron was put together by a small publishing house in Boston, Styron told me, and because he told me about this, I called the publishing house up there and I ordered a copy of this book, and he called John Gardner and asked Gardner if he could reprint in this collection this critical essay, this critical review of Sophie's Choice. And Gardner said, yeah, sure, go ahead, on one condition, that you also publish with it a postscript saying that I have reevaluated my position, I've changed my mind, I now think it's a wonderful book and indeed a masterpiece. Styron said, well, a lot of good that does me now. But can you imagine, here's a guy who is taking to task a book that is conceded to be a fine example of modern literature. Styron is expected to have a tough skin, as you say. And here is a critic who takes the book apart and then says, no, I was wrong, later after he's done the damage. How does a writer react to something like that?
Well, the last thing you must ever take to heart are reviews. I take most to heart the responses from my peers. I don't mean by that reviewers or fellow writers, but the responses to my work that's continually the most gratifying to me are the responses I get from other novelists that I admire. It matters a great deal to me that Vonnegut likes my work, that Günter Grass likes my work, that Peter Matheson likes my work. And so often by the time a book is published, the people who matter most to me, whose opinion of my work matters the most to me, have already read it and written to me about it. And the event of the book being broadcast to a public is rather anticlimactic. I think if you're not well known, you have reason to complain about misrepresentative reviews, because when a writer isn't well known, and for three of my six books, I was certainly in that situation, and really for the fourth, The World According to Garp, I came into visibility with that book, still as a relatively unknown writer. You do need a favorable, or at least a widespread, if not a favorable, critical response to your book, simply because the reviewer is a necessary middleman between what you've done and the public's attention of it. Once you have an audience, which I have, and which Bill Styron has, you don't need a middleman to announce your existence to readers. You have an audience that's going to pick up your next book on the basis of how much they've enjoyed your past books. And whatever the base of that audience is, if the book is good, and I'll say something very simple about what I mean by good in the case of readers. If the readers finish the book, if you write a book that readers finish, the first 200,000 readers will tell at least another 200,000 people that they ought to read that book, which is more to your advantage than all of the controversial, all of the wildly negative, and all of the wildly enthusiastic reviews you might receive. It's, of course it's upsetting personally to see something that you feel may be your best work completely trashed or completely ignored by someone, especially you know is your inferior. It's an old joke among writers that critics don't usually write themselves or can't. But I think there's a better joke about most reviewers, and that's about how badly they read, whether they write or not, on the side or on their own. And what I mean by that, all I mean by that is, most of us, when we become grown-ups, when we stop going to school, do what other healthy people do when they're encountering a book they're not enjoying. They don't finish it. One of the privileges of getting out of school is that you no longer have to read things that you're not enjoying. It's really a perverse act to continue to read something that's not giving you pleasure. There's no reason for it. And yeah, I think it's...
You have to be someone like myself who does a broadcast about books and authors 5 days a week.
And I think it has a very detrimental effect. And understandably, if I were in a position, in a weekly, monthly way, of having to continue to be a student for the rest of my life, of finding myself 100 pages into a book that I'm loathing and knowing that I've got 600 pages more to go, and not only that, I then have to say something about it, boy, I would be cross and cranky too, you know?
So narcolepsy. No, I swear, I usually try to read it on weekends. So this past weekend, I had 5 interviews this week. And it's important to talk to these people like yourself. I mean, you and most of the people I've talked to are important writers, and they deserve an audience, and I wanted to talk to them. But sometimes I read some books that aren't as good as others, and I'm sitting there, and, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, I've had a good night's sleep, and I'm sitting there reading the book, and I begin to drop off, and before I get up and make myself a cup of coffee, and I try to stay awake. Just it's terrible. And I thought, this used to happen to me when I was in college. I'd be
right.
In the middle of some philosophy class in the afternoon,
but
and I'd
know,
begin to
as
drift
you
off.
Must know, our capacity for all-nighters sort of deters as we grow older. Bill Styron is a friend of mine, and John Gardner was also a friend of mine, and I think it's awful when another writer, especially. I think it was. I think it's bad behavior of another writer to speak harshly of a fellow writer's work. I write book reviews, but I only write book reviews of books I love. Well, that's a luxurious position. I don't have to make my living reviewing books, and I'm not being sarcastic. I do feel sorry for people who do have to make their living by finishing things that they're not enjoying. I think it's somehow damaging to the process of writing about what good reading experiences are, but it's just not true that a bad review can damage a writer with Styron's audience or damage a writer with my audience. And Styron and I fully expect that a fair percent of the reviews we're going to get are going to be negative. When you're in a position where you can fairly be said to be mainlining an audience, to be overstepping the role of the middleman and getting directly into the hands of your readers, this attracts a certain hostility in the reading, reviewing community. You begin to resemble, in many reviewers' eyes, a kind of pestilence that can't be stopped. And I just think that goes with the territory. You can't have the many appreciative readers and the appreciative reviewers that Styron and I and Vonnegut and Roth and Updike and any of the writers who have a sizable audience an exciting cardiogram of reviewers' responses. You can't have sort of great and especially popular responses to your work without having fairly vicious detractors. I mean, you just got to expect it. And I don't think you can say that your work is damaged by that. Fortunately, we're not in the position that playwrights are in. I mean, reviewers of theater reviewers are really terrible because they really can kill a play, and book reviewers can kill unknown books either by failing to review them at all or by being condescending or dismissive. I do feel that a couple of my earlier books were damaged by either negative reviews or simply, and this was more the case, not enough reviewing of any kind.
But the same token, some loathsome books are published all the time, and they're made to be bestsellers. The publishing house has decided this is going to be a bestseller. Here's a press kit. Here's a nationwide tour for the author. 100,000, 200,000 first printing. And all sorts of publicity and hoopla, and they're bound and determined to make that a bestseller. It doesn't matter if it's not a worthwhile book. But anyway,
here's something that's true. All the publishing enthusiasm in the world can sort of bump you on the bestseller list, but the only thing that will keep you on the bestseller list is that the first wave of readers compelled to read the book tell another wave of readers to read it. That simply has to happen. I've seen books go on the bestseller list on the basis of very strong literary reviews, too. But if they're not readable books, they don't stay on that list. Well, they pop on and slip off.
Heavily literary books are tough to sell. People do like to be entertained. And some people say, look, I don't want a message. I just want to read a story.
But I don't feel that being entertained is necessarily a contradiction to being literary.
I don't either. But listen, time is almost over, and I want to talk more directly about your work, because the Sidehair House Rules is a book that I did not fall asleep in as I read the book. Several things struck me about the book. And matter of fact, several things, and this is consistent with all of your work, and that is your extremely strong characterizations not only of the major characters, such as Dr. Larch and Homer Wells, but the small subsidiary characters, some of whom pop in and out of the book, like Mr. Rose and Melanie, who should have been Melody. I mean, these are all strong characters, even though they don't play top roles necessarily. Tell me a little bit about your approach to characterization, because apparently you devote as much time and attention to the minor characters as you do the major ones.
Well, I do, because in some ways I think that you have to invest minor characters with more graphic or more instantly graspable details than you really need to employ in the case of your major characters. You've got time with your major characters. You can be patient about giving them habits, about watching out for their own repetitions, their own growth. If it's a minor character, that's a character that people have to have a picture of almost instantly, and so I think they require, in a way, like the landscape in landscape painting, you can't have a view of the whole landscape without having a very good particular tree, and minor characters are the particular trees of a broader landscape painting. What's wonderful about a Corot is the whole effect of it, of the cows, the languid feel, the sense of heat, the hazy light. But the whole thing wouldn't give you that impression if every little detail wasn't done with a very fine hand. And I think that characters are like that. I mean, you care, it's because you care most about the novel as a whole that the brushwork with the smallest detail really has to be pretty fine. In a way, characters like Dr. Larch and Homer Wells, the main characters in my novels, they're much less intensely described. I, for example, have a much less physical impression of the main characters in my book than I have of the minor ones. The minor ones have all sorts of tactile details about them: height, weight, dress, mannerisms. Where the larger characters take on the shadowy qualities of what we call presence, I guess, in a character more than detail. I couldn't tell you myself, although I may have said so four or five different times in the book, exactly how tall or how thin or how thick Dr. Larch is.
I think you compared Homer to Wally in the book.
Homer, yes, similar. But I don't.
But I can't picture Wally that well.
I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you right now whether I ever described Dr. Larch. I think at one point I talked about the liver spots.
I don't know if you did, but I do have this. I don't know if he wore his glasses or had a mustache. I just somehow created my own image of him.
Well, I think that you have more freedom to do that with characters who are in the mainstream of a book. There's no one who does this as well as the Canadian writer Robertson Davies. I mean, his touch with minor characters, perhaps because his background is in the theater. And he knows that the more briefly a character is going to be given time to make an impression on the audience, the more forthright and distinctive the details of that character going to have to be.
You have a postscript that explains some of this, but perhaps you could elaborate a little bit. You must have done a tremendous amount of research on the medical aspects of the Cider House rules, for example, the very graphic descriptions of abortions and autopsies and this sort of thing. And you made reference to Gray's Anatomy a number of times in here. I guess that helped you somewhat. How did you approach this part of the research?
Well, I needed to have a very reliable medical man who had as much enthusiasm for this novel as I had. I mean, it wasn't enough having someone who was an authority. I had to have someone who was really relished it, who really relished getting new material, who really relished looking at first drafts, who and I found such a person. I found him at Yale Medical School, a surgeon, and a medical historian who was just perfect for me. And with his help and the help of three or four other doctors, I had finally, after a year and a half, a great sense of freedom. And what I mean by that is I knew that if I made a mistake, these, in the best sense of the word, fanatics, would catch it almost before the type was dry. And that gave me a tremendous amount of confidence.
Did you sit in on any abortions?
I looked at a lot of stuff, everything.
So you were able to actually see what they were doing as well as...
Well, of course, you've got to remember that this book begins in the 1860s and is over in the 1950s, so that much of the obstetrical procedure that's described in the book it just isn't done anymore. A lot of the problems faced at the turn of the century, eclampsia, for example, are not things that... one sees routinely or even at all anymore, so that the stuff that was possible to see now was a lot easier to grasp than the things that were available to me only in photographs and films and in talking to sort of older medical people, because much of this book concerns medical procedure as it was. It has very little to do with, in the case of abortion, for example, the only acceptable and standard form of abortion medically at this time is a D&C. We're talking long before the days of vacuum aspiration and a lot of modern techniques that have made the process easier.
Dr. Larch's attitude toward abortion, does that reflect your own?
My feeling about abortion is that forgive me, my own attitude is my own business, and I feel that everyone's own attitude is his or her own business. I feel it is probably one of the most deeply personal, moral, religious decisions that an individual has to face, and that the privacy regarding that decision is sacred. So I don't reveal personally what I feel about abortion. Obviously, because of how conflicted the feelings between Dr. Larch and Homer Wells are, I would never mock what anyone's personal convictions about abortion are. I very greatly mock the instinct then in our history and in some voices now, the impulse to make abortion illegal. I believe that a view taken toward abortion, whatever it is a religious point of view, and I don't believe in the United States that we can fairly legislate religious points of view.
Well, I ask you that question because in reading the novel, it was not clear to me if you were trying to make a very specific pro or con point about it, because there's a lot of ambivalence about it.
I think the truth is there is a lot of ambivalence about it, and I felt that the conflict that suffered between Dr. Larch and his favorite orphan on this issue is a conflict suffered by many people today. I don't think there's any ambivalence regarding the legality of abortion. Most of the terrible things that happen in the Cider House Rule are precipitated by that climate of illegality. And it's my hope that the book as a document, the book as a historical novel, fairly accurately and convincingly creates a condition that most people wouldn't willingly want to have returned.
The rules in the Cider House, which of course materialized as the title, I was thinking about them. I was trying to apply them as kind of a metaphor for the book, and I wasn't too successful. Maybe you could tell me if the rules in the Cider House can be applied generally to things that happen in the book.
Well, the rules in the Cider House, of course, is, as you know, refer very specifically to both trivial and essential things. They cover quite a wide range of no smoking in bed, no falling asleep in the cold storage, no drinking on the roof, to rather practical matters like cleaning the pomace off the screen of the apple grinder, which is a part of the milling process for making cider, before the pomace dries. In other words, it's a mix of rather practical, commonsensical things, and rather fretful, worrying things that could fall into the category of personal points of view. What's true of all the rules is that they're ignored. And they're ignored in the case of the migrants in the Cider House camp, because the migrants are illiterate and can't read them. That's a joke. It's not so much a joke. Those rules at the orphanage at St. Cloud that Dr. Larch chooses to abide by, and those ones he chooses to ignore. The whole book, Homer's affair with his best friend's girlfriend, later his best friend's wife, the whole book concerns the ardor, if you will, of choice making regarding the rules. Rules we live by, rules we love by, the public law regarding abortion, and the anguish of that law as it affects a practicing obstetrician who's the director of an orphanage in a rather isolated piece of the rural, poor landscape. I'm implying only that the Cider House rules are made by whichever character is strong enough to sort of make up his own set. The real Cider House rules in the book, in the real migrant camp, are made by the crew boss, who is a rather formidable and frightening character. Some of his rules make sense, and some of them are totally criminal. I think there's as much confliction in that title as there are in the notion of in our lives, morally, regarding the choices we have and the rules we're going to pay attention to, and the rules we're going to ignore. Deciding as an individual that abortion is wrong should be everyone's choice. Deciding that you must have one should also be everyone's choice. But it doesn't make it, that decision, any easier. To make that decision a matter of legality is to take these rules out of the hands where they belong.
Well, the horror of parts of our lives, such as aspects dealing with abortion, is certainly well counterbalanced by some hilarious scenes in your novel. One scene of Mr. Rose on the Ferris wheel, for example, is just absolutely hilarious. One thing I did want to ask you, we're really out of time, but one thing I did want to ask you before we leave, Dr. Larch is addicted to ether. I never heard of that. I never heard of that before, as ether being an addictive type drug.
Well, Dr. Lodge is a conservative, and as it says in the notes to the novel, which really aren't obligatory, I don't even know if everyone will read them, ether addiction is a good addiction for a conservative. It's a relatively safe addiction. It's certainly the safest of the inhalation drugs. An addiction to chloroform would be pretty risky, since the induction time is so rapid. You'd be out before you could do anything about it. Ether is very controllable.
What an odor, though.
Well, the odor you may remember from ether...
From my tonsils, 1945.
Is being anesthetized. Being anesthetized by ether is quite different from being an ether addict. An addict does not anesthetize himself. He does not put himself that out. There's a terrible, frightening moment when you're being given ether as an anesthesia, when you feel you're suffocating. And it makes the odor of it makes a lot of people nauseous, makes me nauseous. But it was a fairly common, cautious, one foot on safe ground addiction in its day. It was quite satisfying, gave you a wonderful... wonderfully transported sense of leaving your body and often the earth. It gave you a rather elevated sense of being above your own, both literally as if in an airplane, but more broadly than that too, it gave you a sense of being able to see whole batches of your life in the past. It's quite visionary in its dream state, and it's quite relaxing. And if it doesn't make you nauseous...
I don't know if we should publicize it. It might take over here in New York.
Well, of course, it's little used anymore today, but in the period that I'm writing about, it was not uncommon.
Laura, you have another appointment soon?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, because we really are just about out of time. Do you always have a project going, or are you, after you finish a book, do you just take a long rest?
Well, I sometimes take a long rest, and I sometimes fill that time with little projects. I don't go directly from one novel to the next. In fact, if I've learned anything about writing over six books, it's that the book seems to be better written if I wait as long as I can before beginning it. That is, I'm better and better nowadays at taking more time between books and taking less time to write them. And I think those things go together. I think the more thinking out of a book you do before you write it, the more note-taking, the more outlining, the more just sheer daydreaming about a book you do before you write it, it's really going to be to the book's advantage.
Well, the Cider House Rules is a big book. 560 pages, and I was wondering how do you approach a book the size of something like that? You mentioned outlining. Is this very important? You know, a lot of people say, look, I don't know from one word to the next, one chapter to another, but it looks to me like things pretty well came together over a period of time in this book for you, so you must have planned it pretty well.
Well, I did plan it pretty well. The part of a book you can't plan is the middle. The part of a book I sort of go to first is the ending. I have a very developed sense of the ending before I have a developed sense of any of the rest of the book. And I wouldn't be able to know where to begin a book if I didn't feel fairly secure regarding what the ending was going to be. And in this case, actually, I'd written 90 or 100 pages of the scenes in that migrant camp, the incident between Mr. Rose and his daughter, before I ever began this book. And that's fairly typical to my method. What I never know is, once you have a good grip of the ending, you have a strong sense of where it should begin. But what I never know is how long the middle is. I might be 200 pages into the manuscript, and I now have a very firm hold on the beginning of the book, and I see more and more clearly the end of the book, but at that point I have no idea whether I'm 200 pages away from the middle or 200 pages away from the end.
And one thing that I notice characterizes your books, all of your major, your last three books, there's always a large institution involved somewhere. For example, the orphanage at St. Cloud's, and, of course, the boys' school in Garp, and the boys' school in the hotel, and the hotel in Austria, and the hotel in New Hampshire. It looks to me as though you're always finding an extended family to work with and to generate your characters, and a focal point for all of these people to pop in and out of.
I think that it's a coincidence that they're institutions in the three books. But the phrase extended family is very accurate for me. I'm thinking presently about a book regarding a scandal in a small town, and I don't think that this scandal could qualify as an institution, but it fits what you're saying in a sense that as an event, it so connects the members of that community that its very existence makes everyone in the town who's involved in the scandal or even knows about it members of a family by association. I'm comfortable with that. Someone asked me when I was midway in this book what I was writing about, and I said orphans and orphanages. And they said, oh, you always write about families. I mean, isn't that a departure? And in my opinion, the collected spirit of being orphaned is as much of a family by association as anyone I've ever written about, and I would connect with the family of orphans in this book, those migrant workers in the camps at Ocean View, with those actual orphans.
Any chance we'll see Cider House on film in the future? Probably pretty good chance, I guess.
I'd be very surprised, frankly. I don't think it's going to be made.
Well, it'll certainly be a controversial film, I would think.
I just don't think anybody's going to make it.
Don't hold your breath. I bet you we'll wind up seeing. I hope so. The problem that I can't remember who directed... Who directed Hotel New Hampshire?
Tony Richardson, British director.
Yeah, the problem that he had with that film is that he was so literal to the book. And that's very difficult to condense. That was another huge book, and to put that into a time frame of 2 hours or so, boy, that was tough. I sometimes wish if he had to make that into a film, if he had maybe taken just half of it. I mean, he could have taken just the part in Austria, for example. But he told the story from beginning to end, which was, I mean, certainly a salute to the author, but I'm not sure that was easy for the director to pull off.
Well, his original idea was to make a film in two parts, and I think that he was always sorry to abandon that idea. He really wanted to make a part one and a part two, which would have, I think... given the film of that book a little more expansiveness and
exactly.
A little less compression than it had. But I naturally appreciated his fidelity.
Well, you know, when Ilya Kazan directed East of Eden, he only used the last 90 pages of that book. And a year or so ago, the complete East of Eden, beginning to end, was made into a miniseries on television. It wasn't bad, but because it was an early generational novel by Steinbeck, you could easily have, which was not really applicable to Hotel New Hampshire, but I'm just making this point. But that was a kind of book, East of Eden, that you could compartmentalize pretty well because the characters changed. I mean, they died and new ones sprang up and this sort of thing. So that was easy for Kazan to do. And a lot of people saw East of Eden in the movies and never realized it was only a quarter of the book. But John Irving, I've got a million more questions, so maybe we could make this part two at some other time. And I really appreciate you coming in. We talked for half an hour longer than I expected, but certainly responsive, and I appreciate you coming in. It was a real pleasure meeting you. I swear I did not fall asleep when I read the Cider House Rules. And
thank you.
It's a wonderful book, and I wish you the best with it.
Thank you.
Thank you.